failure. What does that word bring to mind? What incident does that conjure up? You hear the word failure. You could imagine that you're a UVA sports fan and you witnessed the biggest upset in NCAA basketball history last March, followed by another loss to the Hokies. Just imagining you were such a fan. But failure stings, doesn't it? It truly stings. My alumni magazine from Middlebury College has a whole section on failure, and much of it is the genesis behind this sermon. And a professor writes in the magazine, Stephen Kiernan wrote, "In the end, my first book received 37 rejections. I remember that number because it is the number of publishing houses in America at that time. They all said no." And artists, for sure, outwardly suffer the most. I mean, because you're putting yourself out there, or a leader. Anytime you step out into the sort of firing squad, you're putting your own stamp or your creative stamp on a project. Then a rejection or a failure feels like a direct slap to the face, doesn't it? Or a punch in the gut. Because what it really is more of a measuring stick, isn't it? That sit there and says in a small or maybe a loud voice, you're a failure. And how quickly, right, does it become not the project that was the failure, but we turn it into feeling like it was us that failed. Will McDonough, who's a graduate of Middlebury and a teacher in the Northeast, an English teacher, he wrote in this magazine, "I still struggle to believe that my worth is not the result of my performance." Right? How true is that? I still struggle to believe that my worth is not the result of my performance. And this is why failure stings so much. And why when we start to think about failures, it just gets uncomfortable. I think I put this sermon down like 6 times. There's a sign when you're on to something difficult in a sermon because you fall asleep. Or at least I do while you're writing. You're just like, well, I'll take a little nap. As if that's going to write the sermon. You think it does, but it doesn't. And so then you come back and you're thinking like, well, how can I share some failure? And I remember before my vocational change, and I thought that I would follow in sort of the natural trajectory of being a businessman. And so I'd go to business school and I applied to UVA's Darden Executive Program. And then in the mail the next day or a couple weeks later came the little envelope. Nobody wants the thin envelope. Not from schools, right? It just said, sorry, we appreciate your applying, but it's been, you don't even read what it's reading, right? It's been a really tough applicant pool and you didn't make it. But all you remember is the rejection. Because there's no bigger failure than when you're putting yourself out there for a college or a grad school, right? Because you're basically putting yourself into words, into a CV or essays, and then having people reflect back or measure. And it knocks us off our plans. Then failure redirects our lives into something else and opens other doors, but maybe closes some. We also don't even like watching failure, do we? I mean, I've heard people, back to my poor UVA sports teams, people tell me, I just hated to watch them lose to the Baltimore, to UMBC last spring in the NCAA tournament. Like, we don't like to watch people fail. I don't know if y'all remember when Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature. It was about 2 years ago in December. And Patti Smith was, you know, Bob Dylan in his customary Bob Dylan way said, I'm not going to come and receive my award from the King of Sweden, but somebody can play one of my songs and they'll read a letter that I'll write. And so Patti Smith was selected to sing a song, and she got to pick what tune she would sing. And she sang that beautiful ballad, A Hard Rain Is Going to Fall. And I don't know if anybody remembers watching it, but she failed. She couldn't get through the song. On this world stage with the king and queen and all the judges and being broadcast around the world, a song that she had practiced and that she knew so well because her and her husband used to sing it. She just couldn't get through it. And it's gut-wrenching to watch it. I mean, you're instantly pulling for it because nobody wants to fail. And nobody wants to watch either a friend or a foe fail. And this is especially true when we get to the relationships between parents and children, or grandparents and grandchildren, or teachers and students, or mentors and mentorees, right? Like, that's where it's even more poignant. Remember that term, the helicopter parents? Happened in like the late 90s, early 2000s. And those are parents that just basically flew above their kids, you know, metaphorically, try to protect them from everything. And there was all kinds of awful things that came out of that. But at its root, you understand why they wanted to do it. Who wants to let their kids fail? I certainly don't. Well, it's a good thing because we have a new word for this now. In case you didn't know it, they are now lawnmower parents. We've moved past the helicopters, and now we're on the lawnmowers. And I quote from a USA Today article, the lawnmower parent will intervene or mow down any person, any obstacle that stands in the way of their child's growth and development. And they will prevent any inconvenience, problem, discomfort, or failure from happening if they can. Now, failure, no one wants it. Everybody wants to truthfully run from it. And this is, in a way, you know, in the modern, and there's some articles out in, on the World Wide Web that talk about failure as the sort of the piece to unlock creative genius. And that's true. But don't glorify failure. At the end of the day, nobody wants to go through the crucible of failing. Even if there are things on the other side that may be good. But nobody wants to go through that moment. And failure is precisely what theologian Robert Capon calls the dark center of the gospel. Failure is what Robert Capon calls the dark center of the gospel. And it is the truth of Jesus' ministry, and it is the truth of what Jesus is talking to Pilate about today. The context of this conversation between Pilate and Jesus is that the chief priests, the religious authorities, have ruled that Jesus needs to die, i.e., his ministry needs to fail. Because this will either prove that he is the Messiah, because the true Messiah, the restorer of the people of Israel, cannot fail, but they're going to test him by trying to kill him. Or it'll just prove that he was just a wonderful teacher and a healer, but he wasn't the true king or the Messiah. In other words, they're secretly rooting for him to fail. But they can't do it alone. They have to co-opt in the Roman authorities, because the Roman authorities are the only authority that's granted permission for capital murder. They can't kill Jesus without Pilate's assistant. So enter this exchange, this tense exchange we heard today. And it starts with Pilate trying to figure out what kind of king is Jesus. And Jesus is like a skilled courtroom lawyer, because he wants to really know. You notice how he doesn't answer the question. He wants to know, what are you really getting at? Who really put you up to this? What are you trying to prove? He's trying to push beyond, in other words, the surface idea of kingship, and push into a deeper idea of what is his truth or his kingship. Because if we go by the surface idea of kings, right? Kings have power. Kings have wealth. They lord over servants. They use force to maintain their authority, and they almost always get their way. With Jesus, none of these are true. He was born in a manger, and he has no power. He gives up all of his power. He doesn't lord over anybody, but he serves everyone. So Jesus says, okay, I'm a king, but not the kind of king that you're thinking of. Because the other trait of those worldly kings is that they do not fail, right? But I'm not a king of this world. He goes, my kingdom comes from the other world, another world, not viewed through an analysis of success or failure or strength or weakness. That doesn't apply. It's the hinge that the whole entire gospel moves on when Jesus says, I am not of this world. This is not my kingship. And he directs us the next sentence to truth. He says, I've come to show truth. The truth is about God and about Jesus is that his kingship, his lordship comes from God, not from human constructs, not from what we think about as political building blocks marked by successes and failures. Because the truth about failure is that it still stings, remember? It stings and it leaves a mark. The further truth about failure is that it's also many times the best thing that can ever happen to us. Like I mentioned, my not getting into business school led me to look at another program at Georgetown that was infused with Jesuit theology. I find myself standing here now 11 years later. However, that sting of the little envelope is still there. Nobody likes to talk about it. I thought about taking it out like 10 times and just coming up with something about the kids. Because it still stings, doesn't it? It still stings. And that's what Jesus is really getting at today, is that the truth of the kingdom of God is that it's marked by failure. It's the deep center of the gospel, is a failed ministry. Because Jesus will be crucified and he will die. Meaning, everything that we hold value in the world since will go away. The king will be sentenced to death. And this becomes this dark center of the gospel because it's the good news, because in this death we then are given life. It's the paradox that we hear about every time we think about the good news that through one man's death we all have life. That we're no longer judged or measured by our successes, and especially not by our failures. Rather, it has been finished, and we are home and saved with God. It's what we mark today in our service of holy baptism. The symbol, the symbolicness of putting the water harkens back to when Christians all around the world used to only be fully immersed and dunked to completely symbolize that you were dying and then rising to new life. A new life of freedom, a new life of love, a new life of grace, a new kingship. And that is the capital T truth of what Jesus is getting at today. It's the one place that we truly know that we are saved and accepted. I'll close with a story by Robert Capon. He tells a parable about how this works in our lives, this idea of the dark center of the gospel. So the world would say that if you were to have a movie of a lifeguard, it would happen like this. You would have a lifeguard on a beach and a lot of people having fun and watching everybody swim. And then out there might be a young lady who begins to drown. And the lifeguard would grab the buoy and run out there, right? And grab the young lady by the arms and swim to shore. Get the young lady on the ground and the people would all huddle around. Maybe she'd cough some water up and she'd be safe. She'd be safe. He'd be the hero. The paradox of the gospel is this. The story and the setting is the same. The lifeguard goes out and tries to find the lady. And then he finds this young woman swimming and he puts his arm around her. He gives her a kiss and he tells her how much he loves her. And then they begin to sink. They begin to drop down. And they disappear. Everybody at the beach is like, oh my God, what just happened? And they look back the lifeguard stand, on a big board, it reads, "Do not worry. She is safe in my death."